And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, you know, I make it a point to stay away from politics, but sometimes elected officials say some of the stupidest things. President Biden was asked why he hadn't gone to the southern border. Oh, he came down here 13 years ago. He knew all about it. And since the border goes right through the middle of El Paso, he's been to El Paso. Well, having lived here for almost 30 years, I can tell you the border does not go through the middle of El Paso. El Paso is firmly on the north side of the border. I can see the border from my rooftop. Assuming that I could go out on my roof, which was installed by a completely incompetent company. But the problem is he speaks without thinking, and then everybody rushes to cover up for him. And Psaki has done everything but contradict the man on a number of issues. Well, that having been said, today's October 25th, 298th day of the year. 67 days remain to the end of the year. On this day in 285, the execution of Saints Crispin and Crispinian during the reign of Diocletian. They're now the patron saints of weather workers, couriers, and shoemakers. Everybody needs to have a patron saint, don't you know? 473, Emperor Leo I acclaims his grandson, Leo II, as Caesar of the Eastern Roman Empire. That became the Byzantium Empire. 1147, Seljuk Turks defeat German crusaders under Conrad III at the Battle of Dorylaeum. Also that same year, the Reconquista. After a siege of 4 months, crusader knights reconquer Lisbon, which was held by the Moors. 1415, Hundred Years' War. Henry V of England, with his lightly armored infantry and archers, defeats the heavily armored French cavalry in the Battle of Agincourt. The English won primarily because of the archers. 1616, that sea captain Dirk Hartog makes the second recorded landfill by a European on Australian soil at the later named Dirk Hartog Island off the west Australian coast. 1747, War of the Austrian Succession. A British fleet under Admiral Edward Hawke defeats the French at the Second Battle of Cape Finisterre. 1760, King George III succeeds to the British throne on the death of his grandfather, George II. War of 1812. The American frigate USS United States, commanded by Stephen Decatur, captures the British frigate HMS Macedonian. 1822. Greek War of Independence. The first siege of Missolonghi begins. 1854. The Battle of Balaclava takes place during the Crimean War. It's soon memorialized in verse as the charge of the Light Brigade. 1861, which was a stupid thing for the light cavalry to have done. 1861, the Toronto Stock Exchange is created. 1900, the UK annexes the Transvaal. 1911, the Shanghai Revolution spreads to Guangzhou, where the King General Fang Shan is assassinated by the Chinese Assassination Corps. Now, the Chinese Assassination Corps was an anarchist group, one of the first organized anarchist movements in China and fiercely anti-Manchu. It aimed to overthrow the then-ruling Asian Goryeo and the Empire of China through the use of revolutionary terror. In 1910, a left-wing Tong Minghui nationalist and later anti-communist pro-Japanese collaborator and president of the organized national government of China during the Second Sino-Japanese War, Wang Jingwei, who'd been influenced by Russian anarchism while studying in Japan, planned to assassinate the Prince Regent Chun, father of the young Shantung Emperor. The plan that was to be carried out in April failed as Wang and his associates were arrested in Beijing in March. But it went on to literally turn the world upside down. 1917. This is the old style date of the October Revolution in Russia. 1920. After 74 days on a hunger strike in prison, the Sinn Féin Lord Mayor of Cork, Terence McSweeney, dies. 1924, the Zinoviev letter, which Zinoviev himself denied writing, is published in a Daily Mail. Labor Party would later blame this letter for the Conservatives' landslide election win 4 days later. Now, the letter was literally a fake document published by the British Daily Mail newspaper. The letter purported to be a directive from Gregory Zinoviev, the head of the Communist International, in Moscow to the Communist Party of Great Britain, ordering it to engage in seditious activities. It said the resumption of diplomatic relations by a labor government would hasten the radicalization of the British working class. And having spent some time there, they're radical enough as it is. It was thought in many quarters that this development would have constituted a significant interference in British politics, and it offended a lot of British voters, which turned them against the Labor Party. Now, even though the letter seemed authentic at the time, most historians agree it was a forgery. And it hastened the collapse of the Liberal Party vote. So in the election that came 4 days after it was published, there was a conservative landslide. And for years after that election, laborites, as they were called, blamed foul play for the defeat, which meant they misunderstood the political forces at work and postponed what A.J.P. Taylor argued was necessary reforms in the Labor Party. But there's still arguments about the validity of that letter, even though the man that allegedly wrote it said he didn't do it. But let's not forget, accusation equals guilt in many quarters, especially in courts here in El Paso. 1927, Italian luxury liner SS Principessa Mafalda sinks off the coast of Brazil. 314 die. 1940, Benjamin Davis Sr. is named the first African-American general in the U.S. Army. 1944, World War II. Heinrich Himmler orders a crackdown on the Edelweiss Pirates, a loosely organized youth group in Nazi Germany that assisted army deserters and others to hide from the Third Reich. And for those that are not familiar, Heinrich Himmler began his career as a chicken farmer. 1944. The USS Tang under Richard O. Kane, the top American submarine ace of the war, sunk by the ship's own malfunctioning torpedo. And that's a bad day when your own torpedo sinks you. 1944, World War II, the final attempt of the Imperial Japanese Navy to win the war, climaxes at the Battle of Leyte Gulf. 1945, 50 years of Japanese administration of Taiwan formally ends with the Republic of China assumes control. Now, the Republic of China is not what we know today as Communist China. There's actually two Chinas. 1949, the Battle of Kunming-Tao in the Taiwan Straits begins. It was a battle fought over Kinmen in the Taiwan Strait during the Chinese Civil War in 1949. The failure of the Communists to take the island left in the hand of the Kuomintang, or the Nationalists, and crushed their chances of taking Taiwan to destroy the Nationalists completely in this civil war. Now, Kinmen County, or Taiwan, is off the coast of mainland China. Greater Kinmen Also known as Queen Maud, is the largest island of the island chain. 1962, Cuban Missile Crisis. I don't like Stevenson shows. The UN Security Council reconnaissance photos of Soviet ballistic missiles in Cuba, and it led to the standoff between Russia and the US. 1971, the People's Republic of China, Communist China, replaces Republic of China at the UN. 1973, Egypt and Israel accept United Nations Security Council Resolution 339, which was adopted October 23, 1973, in order to bring a ceasefire for in the Yom Kippur War. Resolution 338, which had been passed 2 days before, failed. Now, the resolution that was adopted in 339 reaffirmed the terms outlined in 338, returned the forces of both sides back to the position they held when the ceasefire came into effect. And the UN General Secretary wanted to put observers in place to supervise the ceasefire. Nineteen eighty, proceedings in the Hague Convention on the Civil Aspects of International Child Abductions end. 1983, the U.S. and its Caribbean allies invade Grenada, 6 days after Prime Minister Maurice Bishop and several of his supporters are executed in the coup d'etat. As I remember, we had special forces that landed, and because of radio issues, they actually conducted operations using pay telephones. 1995, a commuter train slams into a school bus in Fox River Grove, Illinois. 7 students are killed. 1997, after the Civil War, Denis Sassou Nguesso proclaims himself President of the Republic of Congo. 2001, Microsoft releases Windows XP, which became one of Microsoft's most successful operating systems. 2009, the October 2009 Baghdad bombings kill 155, wound at least 721. And in 2010, Mount Merapi in Indonesia begins a month-long series of eruptions that kill 353 and cause the evacuation of another 350,000 people. What they needed was for the United Nations to issue a resolution forbidding it to erupt. They think they can do anything and everything with a resolution. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays observances. Armed Forces Day in Romania. Christian Feast Day, Bernard of Calvo. Pope Boniface I, Cana, Blessed Carlo Gannocchi. Chrysanthus and Daria in Western Christianity. Crispin and Crispinian, Fructus, Gaudentius of Brescia, Goasnovius, Menes of Florence, Martin and Nestorius in the Nestorian churches, Tabitha, Tigullus, Blessed Thaddeus McCarthy, the 6 Welsh martyrs and companions in Wales, the hallowing of Nestorius. It's the earliest day on which Nevada Day can fall. October 31st is the latest, celebrated on the last Friday in October in Nevada. Earliest day on which October holiday can fall. October 31st is the latest, observed on the last Monday in October in Ireland. Earliest day on which Teacher's Day can fall in Australia. October 31st is the latest, celebrated on the last Friday in October. Lithuania, it's Constitution Day. Russia, it's Customs Officers Day. Day of the Basque Country in the Basque Country, Republic Day in Kazakhstan, Retrocession Day in Taiwan, Slovenia, it's Sovereignty Day, and in Grenada, it is Thanksgiving Day. Yeah, let's see what else we've got. 1984, following reports from Oxfam, Save the Children, Christian Aid, and the Red Cross, they reported 10 million people are facing starvation in Ethiopia. 1.8 million pounds was donated by the EEC. It's thought in 1984 alone, a million people died of starvation in Ethiopia. Aid wasn't enough. In December of 84, music stars around the world recorded Do They Know It's Christmas, and that single raised 12 million pounds for famine victims in Africa. The question is, did any of that money go there? On this day in 83, Ronald Reagan orders Marines to invade Grenada. There were 1,000 American citizens there who were being threatened by the nation's Marxist regime. A week after the Marines invaded, the Marxist government was overthrown. 1944, the Japanese deployed kamikaze suicide bombers against American warships during the Battle of Leyte Gulf. That's the largest naval battle in history between the Imperial Japanese Navy and the U.S. 3rd and 7th Fleets. The British invasion of music continues. When the Rolling Stones appear on Ed Sullivan's variety show, after the clean-cut Beatles, the Stones are considered the exact opposite, became popular due to the very different style and content of their music, and the fact that they had an anti-establishment look. 1970, the Liberian registered tanker Pacific Glory is on fire and continues to spill crude oil into the English Channel, created a huge oil slick. Tanker had 100,000 gallons of crude oil on board, and many feared an environmental disaster as bad as the Torrid Canyon disaster off the Torrid Coast, off the Cornish Coast. The October Revolution took place, where the Bolsheviks gained power from the provisional government. This is the day they captured the Winter Palace in Petrograd. 1933, the Roosevelt gold-buying policy is inaugurated on this date, with the government paying $31.36 an ounce, 27 cents higher than the quotation on the London Gold Exchange. 1935, a major hurricane strikes Haiti. More than 2,000 are killed, many thousands are homeless and hungry. 1948, new hopes being given to the 10,000 residents of Rome's misery belt, which consists of shanties and hovels made out of packing cases, sewer pipes, and war-wrecked cars. These people are living on the outskirts of Rome after the loss of their homes through the bombing and the war. A brand new village was built with 351 two- and three-bedroom homes to house 1,000 of these families. 1950, the Chinese Communists announced that on this date they've increased their army strength to more than 10 million men to free 3 million Tibetans from imperialist aggression. 1952, on this date, was the opening of Agatha Christie's murder mystery play, The Mousetrap. The play has run since that date. It's had 23,074 performances, and it's still running at St. Martin's Theater. She was so sure it was going to be a one-off that she gave the royalties to her grandson, who was born a multimillionaire. 1955, there was a crackdown on the sale and use of stimulants called bennies, golf balls or co-pilots in the trucking industry. Truckers use them to stay awake on their long trips. 1964, Zambia, which was formerly Northern Rhodesia, which is the home of Victoria Falls, becomes the ninth African state to gain independence from the British. The new president of the country, and when it was created, was Kenneth Kaunda from the United National Independence Party. 1977, on this date, 24 people took over the Statue of Liberty in a siege. They said they represent New York Committee to free the Puerto Rican nationalist prisoners. We got lunatics of every shape, form, and fashion in this country. In 2007, the first Airbus A380 began scheduled service between Singapore and Sydney. It's nicknamed the Super Jumbo due to its floor space of 50% more than the Boeing 747. 2009, a double car bomb suicide attack on the Ministry of Justice building in a provincial government office in Baghdad leaves at least 150 dead and over 500 injured. 2011, police arrest 75 outside of the Oakland City Hall while they cleared the campsite of the Occupy Oakland protest movement. 2012, official data stated up to 40% of the fish caught off the coast near the Fukushima power plant are unsafe for the humans to eat. This was over a year after a massive earthquake sparked a nuclear disaster in the area. In 2013, in a rare movement of reconciliation, North Korea returned six South Korean citizens to Seoul. They'd not been on the list of any of those abducted by the North, but certainly they had been held. All righty. You know, there have been so many protest movements, I guess you could call them, who believe they're going to change the world. It doesn't always happen. Many of them are there simply because they want to be known as activists. And I don't know what's so great about being an activist, but there's so many who believe that it's something wonderful. Now, there have been so many scandals that has titillated the public. It's just unbelievable. Now, one of the earliest that rocked Hollywood, that was created pure and simple by an activist who wanted to make some money off a Hollywood bigwig. It's the Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle scandal. Now, there have been hundreds and maybe even thousands of scandals over the course of the last 100 or so years in Hollywood. But one of the first, and probably the most memorable, involved Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle, which really rocked Hollywood in the early 20s. Now, his name was Roscoe Conkling Arbuckle, born in 1887 in Kansas. He weighed somewhere between 14 and 16 pounds at birth, and his brother was so traumatized by the sight of him, he actually ran out of the room. Now, certainly that was not the most positive entrance into the world. And in fact, his father wondered if such a huge child could actually be his. Or did the mother have a dalliance without his knowledge? And the birth was so horrific, the mother never fully recovered, and she had health problems for years. In fact, she died when the child was 12, supposedly from problems caused by the birth. Well, now, shortly after the child's birth, they moved to Santa Ana, California, where Roscoe went on to develop a very strong interest in acting. And his mother tried to encourage her child to develop what she saw as a natural talent. But his father didn't think it was that great. And he continued to tell the child he'd go nowhere in life with that show business stuff. Now, the mother complained that the father was being too hard on the boy. But Roscoe who showed a strength of character to do him good in the years to come, carried on with his dream in spite of that. When he was just 8 years old, he got a job with the Frank Bacon Stock Company. It was a very early company that made films. Well, shortly after this happened, the father left his family and moved to Watsonville, California. He's going to go look for gold. And shortly after that, the mother passed away and decided Roscoe would go live with his father. Since by that point in time, he was the only child living at home. Well, as you might guess, since his father was so opposed to his dreams of being in the movies, the boy wasn't happy. But he went to Watsonville anyway, anxious to discover if his father changed in any way since he'd last seen him. But the father, realizing he was stuck with the boy, disappeared again. So by the time the child arrived at the train station, he was truly on his own. Well, with no choice but to raise and support himself, it wasn't long before Roscoe found his way into show business again. He began singing songs in local theaters, and by 1904, he worked for entrepreneur Sid Grauman. At first, he was a ticket taker and then an entertainer at the Unique Theater in San Francisco. You've heard of Grauman's Chinese Theater. This began a theater career which saw Roscoe touring not only the U.S., but China and Japan as well. His funny routines, his clowning and singing were a huge hit with the vaudeville audience, and he loved the money and the attention he got. By August of 08, he was in Long Beach, where he met 17-year-old Minta Durfee. Size, but he soon won her over with his personality, and they became a comedy duo, and several months later they got married. Well, shortly after that happened, both their careers took off, and they often acted together in early Hollywood comedies, the first one being called Fatty's Day Off in 1913. But while things were going well, it was clear that he never got over the death of his mother and abandonment by his father. He often told Minta he'd never live to be 50. They got married and they were just kids, and he used to drive her to distraction when he would say that. Well, Max Sennett took a shine to Roscoe and offered him a contract. After that, Roscoe's career took off like a bullet. The producer was pleased at how agile the actor was, particularly given his huge size, and impressed by the amount of acrobatic moves he could make for comedy value. He could do backflips, somersaults, tumbles. Well, Roscoe was happy as well. Given the opportunity of signing with a studio, he was able to meet and work with Hollywood star Mabel Normand. And he mentored stars such as Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton. Arbuckle's status as a comedy genius was actually set in stone, and his future looked unbelievably bright. Well, it wasn't long before other studios started to develop an interest in the actor, and a bidding war began, which saw Paramount signing him to an unheard-of million-dollar contract in 1914. And unfortunately, the marriage with Minta began to break down, and they became estranged about the time the Paramount contract was signed. Well, some say the breakdown of the marriage came as a result of a clause in the contract that forbid him to get married, which seems a little extreme, but in those days, certainly it could be true. But the clause was more likely, the cause more likely was the fact the couple had been more through various personal tragedies, including miscarriage, inability to have children, and certainly this would have added to their marital problems. A number of years later, when Minta talked about the marriage, she said, we got married, I was 17 and my husband was 21. That was back in 1908. 5 years later, we agreed to disagree, and I got separate maintenance. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your point of view, there were no children. We weren't angry with each other. We simply decided we'd remain good friends, and Mr. Arbuckle had been very generous in his treatment of me financially. I haven't had to work during these years, and Last February, he made me a present of a very fine automobile. Well, as his marriage was breaking down, so was the state of Roscoe's health. He began to drink, and after suffering from an infection in his leg in 1916, became addicted to morphine. And, for some reason, he developed a distaste for the nickname Fatty that he had had since childhood and was the basis of his screen fame. The characters he played were also often called Fatty, and this was certainly the name by which the media and fans knew him. But it was something he wanted to move away from. He began asking people to call him Roscoe. Anybody called him Fatty to his face and get the reply, "I've got a name, you know." Well, he had a brief period of time running his own film company called Comique. Then he went on to sign another contract with Paramount for $3 million. He had to make 18 feature films. I mean, in those days, $1 million was a fortune, but three? He was on top of the world. Unfortunately, his newfound position as a top earner in Hollywood left him open for trouble. And in September 21, he found out that the higher you climb, the further you fall. And it all began at a party he hosted during Labor Day weekend. Saturday, September 3rd, 1921, the actor drove to San Francisco with friends Lowell Sherman and Fred Fishback. Once there, they checked into the St. Francis Hotel and occupied the adjoining rooms 1219, 1220, and 1221. 19 and 21 were used to sleep, and 1220 was used as a living room. Well, the weekend started slowly and quietly, with the three men being joined by two male friends for dinner. There was some relaxing on the beach, and they had some went to a dance club. Then on Monday, September 5th, Roscoe slept late, and at about 1 p.m., he was sitting down to have breakfast in room 1219. Another friend arrived at the suite and told Roscoe and Fishback he had just seen an actress in the hotel who said she knew the men currently staying in the suite of rooms. When the name was mentioned, Fishback and Roscoe agreed they did know her and they invited her to come over. That was actress Virginia Rapp, who'd been working on the fringes of Hollywood for quite some time. She had known Roscoe for about 6 years. She was accompanied by her agent, Alfred Simonacher, and Maude Delmont, a friend, who was known as a notorious troublemaker. Police knew her well for extortion, blackmail, bigamy, and a lot of other less than positive activities. Well, Delmont and Rapp were known for being a wild pair, and Virginia had a reputation for overindulging alcohol, which caused her to embarrass herself at parties. She used to tear her clothes off every time she got drunk. The reason for this was supposedly the fact she suffered from cystitis, and alcohol brought out the very stomach problems. And according adding to that, sometime before the weekend of September 5th, 1921, she had apparently undergone one of several recent backstreet abortions and is still recovering. Well, the men invited Rapp and her friends into the room, gave them breakfast, and just enjoyed their company. It wasn't long before somebody began serving bootleg alcohol, and the quiet get-together turned into an afternoon party. Now, it's fair to say Arbuckle hadn't planned the party, wasn't particularly keen to host it, but it would seem he didn't have that much to do with Rapp or her friends other than being in the same room at the same time. And he made it clear to his attorney he didn't plan to invite either of those women into his room, and the only people he did plan to ask over was her friend named Mrs. Taub and one other unnamed woman. He later told his attorney they all kept stringing in. I don't know who they were. I didn't invite them. Virginia Rapp asked for music to be played in the room, and so the party guests, including Arbuckle himself, danced for some time that afternoon. Though it was said the actress herself sat down and watched. Well, while Roscoe was having a good time dancing, the party wasn't enough to convince him to change his plans for sightseeing with Mrs. Taub, and by 3, he went next door and got dressed. Several minutes later, he saw Virginia Rapp heading next door to room 1221. But by the time he got to his own room in 1219, she had found her way into his bathroom where she was on the floor, sick and hysterical, and blocking the entrance to the room. He later told the court, "I entered 1219 address and closed and locked the door and went to the bathroom. Ms. Rapp was sitting in there holding her stomach and vomiting. Well, when I entered, not knowing she was there, I bumped her with the door. I picked her up. She vomited again. I was holding her head, wiped her face, and she was holding her stomach. She asked for water, and then I gave her a drink of water, and then she asked for more." At this point, some authors claim Virginia confessed to the actress she was having pains in her chest and alleged she had an abortion. Having lost an unborn child with his wife, the actor was apparently upset to hear this revelation, but he didn't leave the woman to suffer alone, put her on the bed in order for her to rest, gave her a glass of water, went back to the bathroom to shave and change his own clothes. While he was in the bathroom, Rapp managed to fall out of the bed and hit the floor. He said, "I came back and found her rolling on the floor between the two beds, holding her stomach. I tried to pick her back up and couldn't do it." Well, he eventually got the woman back in the bed and went next door to tell his party guest what was going on. Until this time, Maude Delmont had been with one of Roscoe's friends in the bathroom in room 1221, but she appeared on the scene drunk and looking for an opportunity to cause trouble. Roscoe told both her and another guest about the sick woman. They went back to the room to find her sitting on the edge of the bed, tearing her clothes off and frothing at the mouth. Roscoe said, "I pulled her dress down and she tore her stockings and the black lace garter. And then she began tearing the sleeve of her dress." Well, at this point, Roscoe left for a minute and Delmont decided she's going to take charge. By the time he returned, she'd completely undressed Virginia Rapp and was rubbing ice on her. When he tried to object, Delmont ordered him out of the room, to which he replied, if she didn't shut up, he'd throw her out the window. Now, she'd already caused an uproar earlier today by dressing up in a pair of pajamas, drinking and partying so wildly. Arbuckle demanded she leave the party. She refused, but his disgust at her behavior left her fizzing, and she wasn't a woman to forgive. In fact, the decision by Arbuckle to stand up to the woman was to have grave implications for the actor in the months to come. Well, hotel management was eventually alerted about the fracas, and Delmont was first on the scene to greet the assistant manager with the word, "A woman is hysterical here and has tearing her clothes off." Manager entered the room, found Rapp on the bed, almost nude except for a hastily placed bathrobe. She was kept losing consciousness. Well, they all told the manager the woman had become hysterical after having two or three drinks, so the manager later told reporters, "I took it for granted there was nothing more serious than a drinking party." Delmont told the manager she wanted to take Rapp to another room to recuperate, and so he left room 1219 to organize a new room. That's when guest Alice Blake, another unnamed woman, decided to put Virginia into a tub of cold water in a bid to relieve her hysterics. Well, this didn't help, and so they put her back on the bed. Even being picked up was painful to Virginia at this point in time. And she complained the man had hurt her in his attempts to get her from the tub back into the bed. Unfortunately, this particular statement would be taken down and used in evidence against Roscoe. I'm twisted to make it look as though he had hurt her during an unprovoked attack, which was not the case. This whole thing appeared to have been set up for financial gain by Delmont. Now, the doctor was called, and he couldn't find any physical injuries on the girl and told Roscoe it looked like alcohol was the problem. He said a little bicarbonate of soda probably would straighten her right back out. Well, back in room 1219, Rapp's agent took it upon himself to gather up the woman's clothes and put all but two of the garments in a neat pile. The others he took down to his car in order, firstly, to dust off his vehicle, and second, to tease Virginia about the state in which she left her garments when she finally did recover. Well, Arbuckle finally asked Lowell Sherman to clear the room of guests before he left to go sightseeing around San Francisco with Mrs. Taub. Later came back to the hotel where he and his friends dined in his room before he left to go dancing downstairs. Next day, he and his friends left the city and headed back to L.A. by boat. One of the party, Lowell Sherman, told the court he didn't see Ms. Rapp after that, never inquired about her because I didn't take any of it seriously. Everybody seemed to be of the same opinion. She was just ill. He said, I never heard Ms. Rapp express an opinion as to what was the matter with her. Unfortunately, Roscoe and his friends were heading home, but Virginia Rapp's condition grew worse, and after several days of suffering in the hospital, at the hotel, the doctor was called again. He wanted the woman to go to the hospital where she was examined by a series of specialists, all citing her condition as an acute abdominal pain with a fever. So it was finally decided this these symptoms are most likely caused by some kind of internal injury. Maybe an organ had been ruptured and peritonitis had set in. It was later announced the actress's bladder had burst, causing infection, deliriousness, acute pain, and ultimately death. Odd thing about her trip to the hospital was instead of being taken to a general clinic where she could undergo emergency treatment, she was taken to a maternity unit instead. And this strange occurrence went hand in hand with the fact Delmont brought her own doctor in to look at Rapp, the same doctor had performed the abortion just days before. So was Virginia taken to the maternity hospital as a result of complications from the abortion? Well, that does seem to be the situation. And to add further fuel to the conjecture, when the actress passed away at the hospital September 9, 1921, an unofficial autopsy was performed. Allegedly by the doctor who attended her, and all of her female internal organs were apparently removed before her body was taken back to L.A. It would seem highly likely this move was a deliberate attempt to hide the fact she had undergone an illegal and dangerous abortion in the days before her death. Well, both before and after Virginia passed away, Maud Delmont took great delight in telling anybody who'd listen that it was Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle that had killed her. She put the blame for her friend's death squarely on his shoulders and made sure everybody knew about it. According to her, this huge man had crushed her petite friend when forcing her to have sex, rupturing her bladder in the process. And then there were other stories that made the rounds that Roscoe had violated Rapp with a Coke bottle, and this caused her bladder to burst. Well, these stories not only were ridiculous, but also came without any evidence whatsoever. How heavy would a person have to be to cause a bladder to rupture by lying on him? It's true, Roscoe was a big man, but he'd surely have had been considerably larger to rupture an internal organ. And what's more, in bursting the bursting of Rapp's bladder, if it had been caused by a heavy weight, would likely not have been an isolated injury. And the Coke bottle story? Well, there was no Coke being served at the party. And there's no evidence whatsoever a bottle of this nature is anywhere near that suite of rooms. Well, while Delmont had been in the bathroom of room 1221 and couldn't possibly have heard anything when Virginia collapsed in 1219, this didn't stop the police from believing the woman when she described how she heard screams coming out of Roscoe's bedroom. Maybe the most outrageous thing about the Arbuckle scandal is the fact that while Delmont had been known to police as a liar who had committed a variety of crimes, everybody suddenly sat up and took notice when she started lying and spreading innuendo about Arbuckle and Rapp. It's interesting to note that while her friends all stuck by her and agreed with her findings, the other guests denied that any of her stories had the remotest bearing on the truth. Arbuckle himself later said that she made up the stories because she was angry at him, and then told the tale of her becoming so wild at the party he had to throw her out of the suite of rooms. Well, in fact, that everybody in any kind of authority seemed to believe Delmont was incredible given her history. But it's true, in spite of there being not a scrap of evidence against Arbuckle and no witnesses to any crime, the police decided he was indeed to blame for the death of Virginia Rapp, and they charged the man with murder. Captain of Detectives Duncan Matheson told waiting reporters no man, whether he be Fatty Arbuckle or anybody else, could come into this city and commit that kind of offense. He said the evidence showed there was an attack made on the girl. Of course, there was no evidence to show any kind of attack at all, and the fact that doctors treated the woman and believed she was ill as a result of natural causes. If there'd been an injury, they would have found it. Well, Arbuckle's arrest seems to be mainly because of the result of the finger pointing from Delmont and a comment by a nurse named Miss Jameson who'd attended the Virginia rap before she died. According to Jameson, the actress told her several different stories. The first was, after a few drinks, she could remember nothing at all about the party. She didn't remember whether Arbuckle asked or pulled her into his room. The second story Rapp told her was that Arbuckle was to blame for her illness and he had attacked her. And then she changed her mind again and claimed that she didn't remember anything about what had happened that day. Well, the reason for the differing comments was actually very simple. As a result of high fever and infection, the actress was delirious and couldn't remember what had happened after she became ill. But while alone with the patient, Delmont took the opportunity to feed the woman information of her own account of what had happened. This caused many false and misleading memories to be created in the process. And this was the reason that Rapp's story kept changing, and while she had such confusion about whether or not she remembered anything that had happened at all. Well, the bottom line was Rapp was in no fit state to recall any event from the party. If she'd been, she would have known that Arbuckle couldn't possibly have taken her pulled her into the room. There were witnesses in the reception room who had seen, they'd been talking to Art Roscoe during the time when Rapp disappeared. And since they were sitting just yards away from the bedroom door, it would have been impossible for them not to notice the actor pushing or pulling anybody into his room. Well, this whole thing got totally out of control, and Arbuckle was horrified that he was now facing the death penalty for a crime he didn't commit. He refused to give any kind of statement to the police and instead chose to say, remain silent, except to say a few words to the reporters who waited with bated breath and their notebooks poised. He said, "Well, I guess you've got enough for this time." Photographers yelled "Smile" and took his picture, and he responded, "Not under circumstances like this." A few minutes later, he is led from the building, taken to the jail, and his quest for bail denied. Assistant District Attorney told reporters it's not pleasant to take actions like this, but under the evidence, the only thing we could do. Well, Roscoe's friends believed in him and chose to support their fellow actor. Mabel Normand sent word. She and everybody she knew all thought he was innocent. Charlie Chaplin released a statement to say he had no doubt his friend had nothing to do with the death, and Buster Keaton was upset he wanted to give evidence as a character witness. The request was turned down by Arbuckle's lawyers for fear any kind of appearance by Keaton would destroy his career as well. Meanwhile, Roscoe's estranged wife, Minta, flew to California from New York so she could support her husband in any way she could. Reporters flocked to hear her opinion, and she didn't disappoint them. She said, "Roscoe Arbuckle's a big, lovable, pleasure-loving, overgrown boy. The success and prosperity may have been a little too much for him, but he's not guilty of the charge made against him in San Francisco. I'm going to him because I think it's my duty to be near him. I want to help in any way I can." Well, when asked whether the couple are going to reunite, the woman responded, "Reconciliation? Well, that depends." Distraught at what he'd been unfairly accused of a crime he didn't commit, Roscoe wrote to his friend and producer, Joseph Snick, and told him he was absolutely innocent. He said, "I simply tried to help somebody in distress, the same as you and anybody else with human instincts would have done in those circumstances." Well, the trial of Roscoe Arbuckle began on 14 November 1921, at which time the charge had been changed to manslaughter. Every little detail is reported, from what actually went on during the proceedings to what the women were wearing to what the public were gossiping about in the gallery. Arbuckle's estranged wife arrived in the courtroom to support him, and people were so incensed by her presence that it had been said she was abused and even shot at while entering the building. Now, the prosecutor during the trial was a man by the name of Matthew Brady, who had great hopes and ambitions to be governor of California, and maybe even president. With that in mind, he pulled out all the stops to prove Arbuckle wasn't the sweet soul everybody thought him to be. Professional finger pointer Maude Delmont was seen as such an unreliable witness, she didn't even wasn't even taken to the stand. But for those who did make a good argument for Arbuckle's innocence, A doctor confirmed that Virginia Rapp had never mentioned Roscoe attacked her. A chambermaid at the hotel dispelled rumors of her blood found in the bathroom door. Pathology experts were called to testify Rapp's ruptured bladder wasn't caused by external events at all. In fact, it would seem pretty evident from the reports that it was a result of chronic inflammation that came from inside the body, not outside. And another doctor testified that Rapp suffered from acute cystitis, while a friend was called to describe how the actress had often complained of severe abdominal pain over the course of their friendship. Then a Santa Ana sales lady threw light on Rapp's torn clothes by declaring on three occasions she'd witnessed Virginia tear to pieces items of clothing while in the throes of abdominal pain. Another friend also testified how during a party, Virginia ripped off her own stockings to give them to an admirer. Evidence given by the people who witnessed these events was made it very clear Virginia Rapp was not a healthy girl, and she'd certainly been known in the past to tear at her clothes when partying or in pain. While listening intently to the evidence being piled up in front of him, Roscoe was nervously tearing paper into tiny little pieces. When it was finally time for him to take the stand, and on hearing the news he would be speaking that day, crowds gathered outside to such an extent nobody could get into the building until the police cleared a pathway. Once on the stand, he behaved in a calm, controlled, and gentlemanly manner, while his estranged wife and mother-in-law both smiled and nodded their support to him from the gallery. His performance, if you will, was impeccable. His delivery outstanding, and even during what can only be described as a stressful and difficult cross-examination by the prosecution, he always remained composed. The actor told the prosecution how he'd come into his bedroom to dress, locked the door for privacy, and discovered the sick woman in his bathroom. He told how he went out to get help and gave damning evidence against Maud Delmont when asked how he found Virginia Rapp when he came back to the room. He said she was nude. Miss Delmont had some ice and a towel. There was ice on the bed and a piece of ice on Miss Rapp's body. I picked the ice up and I asked Delmont what the big idea was, and she told me to put it back. She knew how to take care of Virginia. Ordered me out of the room. I told her to shut up or I'd throw out the window. Well, after a great deal of questioning, recess was called, after which time the ruptured bladder of poor Virginia Rapp was carried into the courtroom as evidence. The organ was gaped at by the entire room before the theory was presented that when the woman who'd dunked the woman into a tub of cold water caused the bladder to rupture. Then questions are raised about the possibility to burst during a violent vomiting episode or by falling off the bed. And on it went, going around in circles, no obvious answer to any of the theories being presented. After a number of days and much evidence, it was time for the case to be wrapped up, and Roscoe sat quietly, picking at the fluff on his coat, rolling his tie and squeezing his lip while the prosecution tried to convince everybody he was guilty. Well, so determined was the prosecutor to get a guilty verdict, they even twisted the evidence to back up their own theories, claiming Roscoe had put ice on Rapp's body. Before telling her to shut up, he'd throw her out the window. Well, the ice had actually been put there by Delmont. Finally, they tried desperately to discredit every witness who dared to take the stand in defense of Arbuckle before resting their case and allowing the jury to go and make their deliberations. After 44 hours of deliberation, the jury came back to the courtroom and on December 4th gave the news they were deadlocked with 10-2 majority in favor of not guilty. Well, everybody was shocked, especially when it was discovered the woman who'd initiated the deadlock was Ms. Hubbard, a woman who was married to a lawyer who frequently did business with the district attorney's office. And not only that, the woman herself was a member of a feminist organization, which had called for Arbuckle's fans to be banned the moment he was arrested. She's reported to have told the other members of the jury, "I'll vote guilty till hell freezes over." She refused to listen to any information. She refused to reread the transcripts or reconsider the evidence. Finally, another juror decided to join her in her call for a guilty verdict. The entire trial was deadlocked and the mistrial declared. Well, back at home, Roscoe tried to manage the hand he'd been dealt and waited for the new trial to begin. Newspaper reporters are keen to hear his side of the story, and shortly after getting back to L.A., he invited him into his home and shared his feelings on what had happened during the past few months. He said, "This case has put quite a crimp on my pocketbook. I resent the damage it's done to me because I know I'm guilty I'm a victim of circumstances. If I had any connection with the death of Virginia Rapp, I'd have said so. That's the kind of man I am. All the dirt in this case was brought up by Mr. Brady, the prosecutor. The evidence consisted of what certain people thought they knew, not what they were sure they knew. One reporter asked, "Do you want to continue your career?" And he said, "I don't know whether or not I'll ever appear in pictures again. Of course, I want to. If the public wants to see me, then I'll go back to work. If they don't, I'll do something else." He then concluded with the words of an innocent man. He said, "I've spent some very unhappy days, but my conscience is clear and my heart's clean. I've nothing to apologize for." Second trial began January 11, 1922. But this time, the whole experience another disaster. Arbuckle's team, for their own reason, decided their client would not take the stand, and their whole defense seemed to be to lack any kind of energy or purpose. The only shining light came when one of the party guests, Zay Prevost, decided she could no longer remember ever saying she'd heard Virginia Rapp claim Arbuckle hurt her. When presented with evidence of her first testimony, she became hostile and bizarrely told the jury she didn't know if she had told the truth the first time she took the stand. She then shocked everybody by presenting the bombshell. She had been previously arrested by the district attorney and threatened with jail if she didn't make a statement against Arbuckle. This revelation brought claims of impeachment from the prosecution, claiming Provost was a hostile witness who was giving a surprise testimony. The court denied the motion, but even this piece of startling information wasn't enough to help Arbuckle. When his team barely gave any kind of closing argument, some members of the jury took this to be a sign the actor was guilty. After 40 hours of deliberation, they came back to court with a hung jury again, this time 9-3 in favor of guilt. Roscoe was devastated. Proceedings are brought for yet another trial to begin March 13, 1922. Yeah, a lot of lessons have been learned from the second trial. When the third trial went ahead, this time things were different. Roscoe was understandably wondering if he'd ever be a free man again, and his defense team decided they'd be taking no chances. There'd be no softly approach, and they went full steam ahead to prove his innocence. Well, he testified once again. A special emphasis was made on showing Virginia Rapp was not a healthy girl that she had been made out to be in the previous trials. In fact, she had suffered from illness for quite some time. In this regard, a new witness, a nurse by the name of Virginia Warren, was brought into the court to explain how she had attended the Rapp in Chicago when she'd given birth to an illegitimate child some years before. This, rightly or wrongly, convinced the jury the woman may not have been quite the innocent young girl they'd been led to believe. Then another witness, Helen Madeline Whitehurst, came to the stand to explain how she had seen Rapp unwell on a number of occasions at her home in Chicago. Well, at the end of this third trial, the jury took 6 minutes to decide Arbuckle was an innocent man, wrongly accused of a crime he most certainly didn't commit. And in fact, they made it the unheard-of decision to issue an apology to Arbuckle, signed by all the jurors. Well, this is a case where somebody saw the opportunity to make money by making an illegal, criminal accusation against an innocent man. And politically connected individuals jumped on the bandwagon to feather their own nest at the expense of a Hollywood bigwig. Well, on note, we've come to the end of today's show. We'll be back tomorrow. And once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, you have a great evening.